This is the second interview with Barbara Nestor, recorded on October 18, 1974, in her home in South Central Los Angeles. This interview began with a discussion of her ideas on pacifism and socialism, and these went from World War I, actually earlier at the time of the Cuban War, through World War I, and included her attitudes towards World War II. Most of the tape, however, focuses on the period in Denver and Fort Collins, her activity during World War I, her joining of the Socialist Party to show her opposition to the war, and the formation of the colony made up of three communist families in 1919. Information on the colony is particularly detailed. On this occasion, her hearing and general health seemed to be rather good.
Yeah, that had been existing for such a long time. They did like multiple. They did open a new era for education and understanding, and that women were people.
But you know what upsets me so much is it's the same women that are always chosen as examples, and
yes,
a lot of more radical women are forgotten about, and the ordinary woman whose name you don't know is ignored totally.
That's very true. You know, what is horrifying to me in many, many respects is that they thought that giving women the vote, it would stop the wars, because they wouldn't want their sons that they brought forth. But the women, you know, the guy who said that the female of the species is more deadly than the male, well, some of the women are worse, really, than the men in their over patriotism, and what Samuel Johnson said of the patriot applies to the women too, you know. Of course, they cloak it with religion and everything. War always had been, but they don't quote a Salazar. He said that eventually the sword will be beaten into plowshares and man will play, have war no more. They kind of.
Well, Barbara, were you? You brought up your pacifism very frequently. Were you a pacifist before you were a socialist, or were they tied together? What was the relationship?
I think in the beginning I was a pacifist, because I didn't, from the time I remember I was 14 years old when the war against Cuba happened, and I thought then that war is nothing but you're training people to kill one another. And who gets killed except the young people who had nothing to do with it as early as that? So really I was a pacifist, because I knew nothing of socialism by that time. And it wasn't until I was almost 17 that I first heard of socialism, and I knew that men had made this. Men who wanted to carry out certain things, and especially for privilege, and had been, and it would only be a movement that socialism, which said that no one should have control of the organs of production, that they were necessary to all people, and until you had that, why, you'd have a hard time. But that then I saw it in a different light, in a socialist light, whereas before I had been against all war, you know. Then, you know, when they came and said there are just wars. But if wars were stopped in the beginning, there would be no such reason as for just wars, because the conditions would not have prevailed for that. So I've always been, it's awfully hard for me to countenance a war.
Well, how about, but it didn't extend towards violence against an autocratic regime, for instance.
Well, you see, the Second World War had to be fought. But had Roosevelt really been a decent guy, he wasn't. He was a mumser, that's what he was. Because he wouldn't allow 1,500 people who were the poor guys from Germany, he wouldn't allow them to land in New York. Can you imagine that? He allowed all kinds of reactionaries, but he wouldn't allow them. So, you know, I despised Roosevelt, really. But pretty soon, compared to others, by comparison, he, and even Mrs. Roosevelt, who was much, really much better than he, because she had an economic sense, and she didn't tie everything to the... He was a son of privilege, after all. He came from the aristocracy, and he was a son of privilege. And so even though he was a statesman, as far as the others were concerned, he knew more about statecraft. But he wasn't really a very fine human being. If you read what he was doing, he wasn't. But it was all in comparison. Compared to others, he also had a great understanding of the things like he had these little talks, you know, all
he
the time.
Put inside chats.
Yes, they were very effective, you know, because it wasn't like when Nixon said, fellow Americans, but when he said, my fellow Americans, you really felt that he did feel some of that thing, and he did take pride in our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. But of course, he knew also where to limit them and everything. But when I see what Roosevelt did about the Spanish invasion, stopping them, it was a legal government. It wasn't really a socialist government, but far more progressively, but it had come in by the vote of the people. So they had a right to demand, to ask for help. And he stopped the boats from giving them any help for the Hitlerites and Mussolini could have all they wanted. Mm-hmm. So he helped bring about the Second World War. I really always felt very sorry that some of his 5 cents didn't die. Let him feel what others had felt. Because in the American League Against Foreign Fascism, Mrs. Dirling, who was one of the leaders in that movement, she was a very close friend of mine, and I loved her dearly. See, at one time, we had at the library and at some of the schools a forum, and we had various subjects. Now, I became the chairman of the social... understanding of things, and we could bring that, and you know, I met a minister from Denver that I had met at the same time that so many of the liberals were talking there at the Methodist Church. The Methodists did produce quite a few very, very liberal guys, and I met the Reverend Mr. Heist. And he was a wonderful guy, and we became very fast friends. So I had him on my program, and they said what had happened. And we had in that program, here at Manual Arts High School, a man they called Father Clark. He was an Episcopalian minister, but he was a son of a bitch. He was a real fascist. And he had a friend, Mr. Kelly, who was the head of the automobile thing, you know, and everything. And you know what side he was on, the Chamber of Commerce and everything. So when Mussolini invaded Ethiopia, Father Clark said, well, in Ethiopia, they wanted to clean up because they have 50,000 black Jews who are called Falashis. They are filthy, dirty, hardly ever took a bath, and so these are the guys that Mussolini is fighting against, condoning a war like that, such an infamous thing. And that when Mussolini's son said that when they threw a bomb and they saw one, it was like a rose unfolding. To see this man all lit in flames dying was like a rose, you know. It was so horrifying. And I remember that I was chairman of that, you know, and Father Clark knew I had done the little reading. But he was very careful not to attack me. He tried very hard to be friendly, but I despised him. And he said to me once, "You see, most people are very ignorant of the difference between the Immaculate Conception and the Virgin Birth, but I know you're aware of it." I said, "You flatter me. What is the difference?" "I don't know of any difference." He said, "Well, so but I was so angry when he said this that I got up and said, "When you hear a so-called minister of the cloth justify a war that this is such an infamous thing to go into that little country where the people are so absolutely ignorant, they don't know anything at all, they haven't done anything, and to go ahead because they want that territory." Eritrea, I forget the name now. And I said, "And he justifies that, saying that these 50,000 Falashis, very dirty Jews who hardly ever took a bath, was he there? How does he know? I don't know how often he takes a bath either, because what comes out of his mouth is needs a bath." And everything, oh, he could have killed me, you know. And I said, "And Mr. Kelly, who also is there, but Mr. Kelly is one of the big industrialists in this." And I said, "You know, Mr. Kelly, I would advise you to read French history. You know, when Marie Antoinette, poor ignorant Marie Antoinette, said, 'Let them eat cake,' and she made a joke of it, but pretty soon she lost her beautiful head. Really, it was very, very bad because she wasn't the instigator of these things, but she was there. Mr. Kelly, you be careful that some of those things don't happen to you, you know. So when you justify a thing like that, how can you in any conscience justify a thing like that?"
How did the students react to this?
Oh, they laughed. Oh, they were friendly. They applauded. Oh, really and truly. And there was one woman, a Mrs. Bachman. She had a very strong accent, you know, and everything, but she was a smart woman. So Father Clark said, "You know, as far as the Jews," he spoke about the murder group, you know, in New York City, mostly Jews, Levy or Lebka or something like that. And so Mrs. Bachman said, "Well, Father Clark, do you have to have a monopoly on criminals? So the Jews have a few too. But look how many you have." And everything. So she was there. He would try, you can see that an infamous, he was a very good looking guy, and he had been a teacher teaching at the university. And you can see that when he tried to make fun of her, because instead of radio, she called it radio and everything. So he made fun of her. Now, does a really a fine person do that? Because so I said, "You know, Father Clark, she just didn't come as early as you. I don't know when your ancestors left Ireland and when you were just a poor Mick. But, you know, she just came later, you know, and she still hasn't lost her accent. But the content of what she's saying is very much better than what you are." You know, things like that, you know. But I met wonderful people now, you know, there was a professor at UCLA who at 18 years of age had been a communist, and then he became very disgruntled and became so anti-communist you can't imagine. Well, he was one of the guys that Minister Heist wanted me to have there. He said, "I don't like him because but here's the chance to question him and everything, see why."
Do you recall what his name was?
Huh?
Do you recall what his name was? Do you recall his name, the UCLA professor?
The UCLA professor? It will come to me in a moment. Okay. But there are people who remember it. He wrote a book, too. And in the book, he gave examples of what, during the First World War, what we had. And he is the one who would, you see, he did bring out certain things. He hadn't lost all touch with his progressive background, he said they had what they called the Hall of Prostitution, and it was literally a hall of, because they had papier mache figures where they had a German cutting off the breast of a woman and everything, and so they'd give the Boshi and all the names at that time, that they, and they were all figments of his. But they broadcasted that these were the actual things, and he brought out many things. Dorothy Canfield Fisher, in one of her books, brings out some of these things, too. So when I said to him, he didn't know that I was a communist, or at least I don't know if he did or not. But I said, now, I can understand you might have grievances and everything, but I am surprised that a man of letters like you are a professor, about the other thing. He said, well, you can't separate them. It's awfully hard to separate the truth from the chaff, you know, and everything. And when you know people will do this, don't think for one moment that everyone on the left is a pure person who always tells the truth and always does everything. I know when I was there that that isn't so. I said, well, but does everyone on your right always tell the truth and everything? He says, no, but there's no reason to condemn them any more than the others. The others ought to know better, and they don't. So, but I don't know whether much was accomplished by having him. But Mrs. Durning.
What is her name?
What his name was?
What was her name?
Mrs. Durning, D-U-R-N-I-N-G. She was the chairman of the Peace and Freedom Party, and also of the anti-fascist organization. The Organization Against War and Fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And she was one of the finest human beings, brilliant and wonderful. She had one son, 18 years old. He was at Pearl Harbor and was killed at Pearl Harbor when the Japanese came.
Well, Barbara, in terms of your own ideas about war, first you were a pacifist, and then once you developed a socialist consciousness, you're
resisting evil, I think, then we are sometimes forced into it. Like in the Second World War, had a certain act been done, we perhaps wouldn't have, but as it was, I think you had to have it. You had to destroy Hitler and all he stood for.
As an action, but also as to use violence in a revolution, you also approved of, didn't you?
Well, you see, I didn't approve. See, in the manifesto, which became, as I told you, a very glowing instrument, that Marx does say we will not use violence, but if in order to resist violence, we have to use violence to resist violence, then we have no choice but to do that. Then I agree, I have to.
Your socialism then somewhat tempered your pacifist views, and
that's right.
Capitalism then.
That's right.
The violence.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
While we're talking on the subject of pacifism, can you tell me more about some of your activities and your attitudes against the First World War?
Well, when the First World War started, at that time, I was already a socialist, because the First World War, they started, in 1917, and I had become a socialist in 1915. So I was already a socialist, and I understood that. And so we knew that it was a war for markets, and absolutely unjustified, and that Wilson was the son of a bitch who had betrayed it when he had been asked the Constitution. That Washington had said that we should not be embroiled in foreign wars, and Wilson answered that was only a scrap of paper. And then he made another statement. Words, you know, he was a scholar. Words were meant to conceal as well as to reveal thought and everything. Well, you know, but he was a first-class hypocrite, you know, because he said that he, at first, then he had all those terms, too proud to fight, then armed resistance, you know, then the war to end war, with no victory or anything, but self-determination in nations, the 14 points, it all went glimmering. Because when he went to Versailles, and this I read in, did you ever read A Personal History by Vincent Sheehan?
No.
Well, I have a copy if you ever. Now, I think nothing made it so plain of what was happening in China. Because Vincent Sheehan was there, and he met the Russian revolutionists there, and he saw what Stalin did there in 1927, that he needed to help destroy that revolution. That Chiang Kai-shek, who had started as a friend, you know, mm-hmm. and ended up by being a horrible creature. You haven't any idea how horrible and everything. So Vincent Sheehan met all of them, and he too thought, but he never joined the Communist Party, but he thought the Communist was justified. And he went to the Soviet Union and saw what they were doing. But almost all those leaders in the that were sent to China were called back to, you know, I forget names, though, but they were the most famous because they wrote textbooks and everything. They were eventually killed by Stalin.
Now, around what kind of activity around the First World War? The First World War,
absolutely opposed to it. We marched in Denver. The socialists marched in Denver at the Turnhalle. You know the socialist Turnhalle.
What is that?
The Germans had these places, you know, sports things, you know, and everything. But socialist ideas were also discussed, and they had discussion. They were absolutely opposed to the First World War. And we picketed it.
Where would you picket?
We picketed the public buildings. We picketed the churches. We picketed almost anywhere where any speaker came. Mm-hmm. I was almost arrested once because when he was calling for volunteers to help, you know, sell bonds, and I said to him, don't do it. If you're buying bonds, it's only to kill our own boys because this is only for market. This war is for market and not for anything else. And so one of the guys, he was a captain, he had his attention called. He says, you know, that woman there is agitating against it. So a guy from Iowa who had become a very close friend of ours, and he was a tall, skinny guy, but he was a socialist. And he used to come to our place. This was in Fort Collins. So he used to come to our place all the time, and he said, look out, that guy wants to arrest you and everything, so you can't do anything. You've got three little children. Better a moose. So he had a horse and wagon, and he picked me up and put it in the wagon and drove off, you know, just as the captain had assigned someone to arrest me.
Now, was this a rally for bombs? Is that it?
Yes, it was.
And so you were speaking to the people in the...
In the group there, not from the platform or anything. He was speaking from the platform and everything.
Now, this was in Fort Collins, not in Denver?
This was in Fort Collins, but in Denver they had been having even bigger ones all over, you know. They had. This was at the Agricultural College in Fort Collins. There was a whole lot more liberalism, too, at that time, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you would go pick it, it was with the other members of the socialist group.
Oh, yes. Yes.
About many of you would pick at a church, say?
Well, I would say all the way from 50 to 200.
So it wasn't just the members of your socialist group, then. It was a broader group.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
And it was people who
were
against the war, but were not necessarily...
The newspapers and all were for the war. They branded anyone, you know, as yellow who was against it, you know. You know what they did to the flyer's father, you know, who had been a congressman, Lindbergh's father. They painted his house yellow because he was against the war. He was one of the few that voted against it altogether and everything. But his son was no good. He wasn't a fine person, really.
Well, what kind of reaction would you meet when you would go out, say, when you went to the church?
Favorable. I can't remember any girl that anyone ever jeered or anyone ever, you know, threatened us, because most of the time when they had, some who had come, who just really were not informed at all of anything, but when they were really anti-war.
Well, would you hold rallies yourself or your group or just pass out literature? What would you do exactly?
Most of the time we held a rally that was sponsored by the group, by the Socialist Party. And I think I told you about that the Red Cross tried to recruit at that time, and I wouldn't do it. And I was so scared that they would think, you know, and everything. So it started. So in my neighborhood, almost, I didn't know. And at that time, I knew every neighbor because I went all over. None of them were for the war. They were all very anti-war. We had some German neighbors who, after the war was over, when they reintroduced German into the schools, they asked anyone. They had taken the German books and burned them. And my neighbor wouldn't do it, came over and said, "I'm not going to give them." But I said, "Don't you do it. Books should never be burned," and everything. That's horrible. So when they asked for those books to be brought out now because they had none, she wouldn't give any of them to them, you know. But they were so anti-war, almost most of them, the parent teachers were, that they were afraid to come out publicly.
Well, once someone like you came out publicly, did others then support you?
Yes, I told you about the president of the parent teachers who came over and told me how glad she was that I had said this. And the head of the Red Cross, Mrs. Evans, I'll never forget her name, you know, if she didn't agree with me, if she didn't have sympathy with me, she would have reported me. She never did.
So, would you feel that Denver, now, at the time you were living in Fort Collins, is that
at right? This time now, we were still in Denver.
Oh, during the early days
yes.
of the war.
Yes.
When the United, now, once, because the war in Europe actually began in 1914. But the United States didn't enter till
1917.
Now, was there a change in how people would react to you?
No. I think in spite of the fact that, you know, Wilson had been changing all of them one step to the other, you know, when the Lusitania went down, see, there was an awful lot of anger, you know, because some very famous people went down with the Lusitania. Then afterward, it came out that the Germans had warned them not to go on the Lusitania, that the Lusitania was carrying war supplies, and therefore they would be sunk, you know, and everything. And neither Wilson nor the administration warned people not to go. So they really were guilty of murder, because these people lost their lives, you know.
Because in some parts of the country, it seemed that when the government shifted its position, there were extreme attacks on those who maintained their anti-war position. But
well,
you didn't experience that.
Very little of it. I can't remember. I personally can't remember any of it. But some said, you see, what was attacked very much was the IWW. They were the most audible, the most articulate against the war of anyone, you know, and everything. But the socialists were, you see, there were two groups of the socialists. There was a socialist group that supported the war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like, take Jane Addams, who was really a fine person, not only with Hull House, but I had an understanding. She supported the war and went around with selling bombs, you know, and everything, which was, she lost an awful lot of prestige by it too, you know, for the people who would hold with her kind of philosophy were not the kind that supported the war. Anita Whitney broke with her at that time on account of it. And Anita Whitney stayed adamant against the war and really spoke all over and everything, showing exactly who was for the war and why. Well, I remember I remember going to just a so-called valley where I stood at the end, and they said, now if you want to go, enrich yourself now, buy war babies. Now is the time, war babies. Absolutely. It's incredible, isn't it? But yes, you could. Buy war babies. Steel, that's the thing. Steel, buy steel. They have to have steel for war. That's the way to increase your wealth.
Now, when you were involved in the anti-war activities, were you in a, did you form another group, or was it just through the socialist group?
Just the socialist group. But at the parent-teachers meetings that we went to, they had, this was almost at the end of the war, I never forget his name, a Lieutenant Richardson came to speak there. And he said they had taken 200, I remember they had said that all the atrocities were committed by the Germans. They had taken 200 Germans war prisoners. And he said, now this is at a parent-teacher meeting he gave this. And they had these 200 Germans in a wood there. And they said, you know, they were short of food. They said, look, what do? We don't have enough food for anything. He said, so the colonel said, you know what to do with them. Dead people don't need to require food. Put them where they won't require food. And so some woman sitting right next to me got up and said, you know, Lieutenant Richardson, do you mean then that you went ahead and shot these helpless prisoners? He said, well, they were ready to shoot us, weren't they? We took them as prisoners. But what do you think they were going to do to us? They were fighting us. She said, but it does seem a terrible thing. He says, well, war is not a nice thing. War is hell.
Well, even once we were involved at these public meetings, there were other people who were not necessarily radical who would speak up, who continued to speak up against the war.
Some did, yes. But by and large, most of them began to accept it, you know, and think that anyone who didn't, you know, was an enemy and that, you know, it was strange, but not in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Was that because your neighborhood was largely German?
No. The only ones who were German were this one family that I knew, you know.
How do you count for the others in the neighborhood?
They were working people. And who really did have, you know, the labor unions were a bit more progressive at that time and everything. And the labor wasn't, at first at least, didn't support the war.
Mm-hmm. But the AFL then did support it once.
Yes.
Because in fact they agreed to not strike during the war.
That's right. Well, you know, they didn't have any strikes at the Second World War either, you know. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever actually advise men not to go into the army?
Yes.
And you were never threatened with arrest for?
No, well, I told you, the only time was this time in Fort Collins, and I told them, don't join them and don't and everything, because this is just, of course, at that time he was speaking, Pershing had just gone into Mexico. That was before he went across. And he was telling what the Mexicans had done, had come over to a little place on the border, Charleston or whatever the name was, and had assaulted the town and everything, which was a lie, pure and simple. And I said, don't believe him, he's a liar. That is not true, that made up and everything. And don't join them. So that's the only time that I was actually threatened to.
Were there other people in the anti-war group in Denver who were arrested for their anti-war activities? Were there any men in the group who refused to register for the draft and were imprisoned, do you recall?
I think there were some, yes. I think there were some, but I don't really remember how many or anything. But I know there were. Oh, of course there were. See, for one thing I know, even the Women's Temperance Union came out against the war. You know. But it's awfully hard to go against, swim against the current, you know. And pretty soon some got to be afraid to say anything, but they're even against it. They're afraid, you know. It's just like I told you, Mrs. Swain, the head of the parent teachers in my group there, said how glad she was I said it because her parents were Germans, would be accused of German sympathy, and so she didn't dare say it. And she was a nice woman, and absolutely as anti-war as I was in every way.
Were there any of the foreign-born radicals in your group in Denver right after the Palmer raids when they rounded people up and deported them to the Soviet Union? Were there any from Denver who were deported?
Yes. Yes, there were. Most of them, as I remember, were deported. There were a number deported to Mexico and in other South American countries. And there were some who were deported. And this I'm trying to remember exactly, to some of the Slav countries, you know. Anyone who was opposed, you know, with the Palmer raids were a horrible thing. Because for one thing, they went after the foreign born most of all.
Well, the deportations were following the Palmer raids. It was not still before the war was over then.
No. Well, 1919.
Mm-hmm. So it was tied to the Palmer raids,
yes.
Though.
Yes.
How many in Denver were deported, do you recall?
Well, they had arrested 88. 88 had been, I told you about Helen Grutik, who went there to find out, and we found out that the secretary of the Socialist Party that I knew was a friend of mine had been in the employ of the Justice Department and was a stool pigeon all the time. And he was sent as a delegate to help form the Communist Party.
Because I want to get into that more. I just wondered first how many the arrests and deportations tied to the Palmer raids, though not to the anti-war activity.
Well, I think that they deported. Now they arrested 88, and I think they deported at least one half of them. Over 40 were deported. And it was very hard to go to see them, too, you know. They made it very difficult for anyone. If you were a friend of theirs, they had once charged you with the same thing, you see. So people were really afraid to go and see them. Because once they would be suspect, they were friends of these people. So but they did form a committee to help them.
It was primarily to raise money and support them?
Yes.
They didn't come?
And get legal defense for them?
Did any of them come to trial?
Yes, some of them did, but a long time afterwards, you know. And it was always so mixed up with other things, you know, at that time already. See, what was taking place was also with the IWW, like in Washington, Wesley Everett, which was one of the most horrible things he ever did. If you read anything about it, you know. And he was a wonderful guy. I never met him. Of course, I didn't know him. But I met friends of his afterward who came to Denver. And they said he was one of the nicest guys, you know. And he was really, he was not even a very violent guy. He was a very gentle sort of a guy, you know, who hated violence. And only did what, when things had to, that you had to defend yourself and everything. But
well, how many in this group in Denver, who, because you say when you would go to pick at the church or something, you may get from 50 to 200 people. How many of those were with the IWW, and how many of them were socialists? Can you distinguish?
Well, there were many more socialists than IWW, but the IWW were the most forceful in what they were doing because, you know, some of them that I met that afterward became friends, and I said, do you actually let the gas out and put in things, you know? He said, would you think that wrong? I said, no, I don't care what you do to them. He said, well, then we do. He said, you have to fight them with what you have. You can't go ahead and just fight them. you know, this isn't a thing for gentlemen, you know.
Were most of the IWWs in Denver working in the mines, or which group?
They were also working in the fields, carrying their bindle, you know, and everything. Many of them were working in the fields, you know.
They were primarily like the migrant workers.
Yes, they were primarily migrant workers.
Had there been any free speech fights with the IWW in Denver in the earlier days?
Well, the police would attack their headquarters whenever they could, and they generally moved from one place to the other because of that. The police would attack them, yes, they would.
Well, so the IWW did have a headquarters in Denver separate from the Socialist Party.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, we sometimes had at the socialist meetings at Howe Hall, every Sunday we had a socialist meeting. We sometimes had an IWW as a speaker. But they were not the same, with grouping at all, you know. But generally, I thought the IWW made more sense than any of them.
Did you go over to the IWW hall for their activities ever?
I don't remember ever going to their hall, whenever they spoke at our hall, I heard them. And then I became friends with several of them. We used to come over and have lunch, you know, and everything. We talked. One of them I remember was Fanny Hall. I remember her so well. She was a beautiful woman. And she was so articulate. And believe me, she believed in violence first. She said, listen, I've learned to use a gun, and I wouldn't have any hesitation to shoot down any of those son of a bitches. Because knowing what they've done all their lives to all of us, I wouldn't have any hesitation at all. And don't you have it. I said, I don't know how to shoot. She said, I'll show you how.
So there were quite a few women connected with the Wobblies in
Denver. Oh, yes, there were quite a few. And they were very articulate.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, they had made the IWW, I won't work, and all kinds of things to them. Then the most people who didn't know what the IWW were, they really stood out as the enemy, you know, people who were destroying things, you know, infiltrating into unions to destroy it, to weaken it, and everything. They had the popular image of the IWW. The IWW didn't get an awful lot of sympathy except from the people who were very radical.
Barbara, in your, first of all, you went to your first socialist meeting when you were 16, when you heard
Skip Wilson.
Now, did you start to regularly go to meetings after that, or not?
No, because that's the first time I heard of it, and I didn't even know where any meetings were. But a year or so later, when I found out where some of the meetings were, then I went to listen to them. But I didn't actually join the Socialist Party until 1915, and by that time I was 30, or past 30.
But in those years from the time you were 17 till then, did you regularly go to meetings, or you just sympathized?
Yes. No, I went to meetings. Whenever I could, I went to meetings.
Well, what after all those years, what made you decide to actually join at that point?
You see, one thing that one of the reasons that I hadn't joined before was that my children were very young, and I did not believe that anyone had a right to neglect their children, no matter for what cause. Your children you brought into the world, your first duty was to those children, and I couldn't imagine, no matter how holy the cause was, that neglecting your children or exposing them to danger or anything was justified at any time, and I never did. So then that's one of the reasons that I never joined. Well, by the time we were in Fort Collins, Dorothy was only a year old. She was born in 1914, September the 22nd, 1914. So by the time we entered the war, she was over 3 years old, you know. But by the time she was a year old, I felt that no matter who I might not be able to go ahead and do all the things they asked for, but if you didn't join, really, and act as an organized unit, you weren't going to accomplish anything.
So it was, your decision to join then was partially because you felt the children were older, but also that